watching Falcon Benji. You lucky son of a bitch. Subscribe.
Hello and welcome to Malcolm Benji's vidcast. I think we settled on calling it that. And I'm Malk. Benji's otherwise engaged at the moment. But what I wanted to do was something anyone who's followed the podcast will have seen or heard, should I say rather, Benji's retrospective of 2013. If you haven't, go and listen to it. It's really awesome, really interesting. Seen a lot of films. I have not seen that many films in the last year. I'll see them all in the next sort of 3 or 4 years on DVD, by which point it would be pointless to podcast about them. But what I wanted to do to try and sort of sum up 2013 is turn my comic book internet fanboy rage and use it for good instead of evil, and fix some of 2013's blockbusters. I'll not be doing this alone. Benji has contributed to many of these theories, as have some of our sort of friends and loved ones, but they're getting no credit because we're horrible men. But yeah, what we've done is we've taken, I think, 8 of 2013's biggest films, and we're going to, or I'm going to tell you how we think they should have went. Okay, so... Okay, first up, the sort of the opener of the summer tentpole blockbuster season, Iron Man 3, THREE. Yes, we're still doing that. Prepare for it to not get boring. So, Iron Man 3, Marvel Studios 7th, starring Robert Downey Jr. and Don Cheadle and Ben Kingsley and Guy Pearce and so on and so forth. Great film. A lot of fun. No stranger to internet fanboy rage, as I'm sure anyone who's been anywhere near the internet can attest. Lots of sort of controversial choices made in that film. So, a couple of things we want to clear up. Not a lot to do on this one, actually. At least not according to Malcolm Benji. We were fairly happy with it throughout. So the first thing is Rhodey, who Colonel James Rhodes, played by Don Cheadle, who's War Machine / Iron Patriot. Thought he was really good. Happy with Don Cheadle, much better than Terrence Howard. Liked the Iron Patriot armour, the redesign was cool. Liked that they got it in there, avoiding the Norman Osborn rights issue that Sony would have with it. Only change we'd have made is in the final battle at the end of Iron Man 3, we should have put a spoiler warning in on this, actually. Spoilers! It's okay, I've not said anything spoilerific yet. Spoilers for all the films that we'll list in the description on YouTube. In this. In the final battle at the end, when all the other suits turn up and Tony's jumping from suit to suit and he's fighting all the extremist guys and Rhodey gets the President out of danger, puts on the Iron Patriot suit and flies the President away. What I'd have done, rather than put Rhodey back in the Patriot armour, given that the running gag throughout the movie has been that everyone hates Iron Patriot and loves War Machine, they think Iron Patriot's a bit of a joke, it's too cheesy. And Rhodey, kind of for the first half of the film, he's defending it, because he has to, because it's his job. And then when he has to reveal to Tony what his password is, it's War Machine Rocks with an X. So obviously Rhodey prefers War Machine as well, but he's just, you know, towing the company line. So I would have liked, as a nice payoff to that, for one of the suits that comes flying in at the end to be the War Machine armour. And Rhodey gets to suit up and be War Machine at the end, and it sort of resolves that thing. And I would also have liked him, after he's dropped the President off with the nearest batch of Secret Service dudes, to come back and help Tony and Pepper. Because I don't know if anyone else noticed, but at the end of the movie, he just buggers off. And I would have liked him to come back, you know. It's like, and everyone, because of Shane Black, everyone compared it to Lethal Weapon series as well. It is like, Riggs, I'll see you later. And Murtaugh just goes. You know, that's what it's like. So yeah, that's what we'd have done with Rhodey. It would have involved slight rejigging to the earlier portions of the script, because they refer to Iron Patriot numerous times as a paint job. As you know, it's we're clearly told this is the War Machine armour and it's been upgraded and changed. Whereas you would need to set up that this is Rhodey's new armour. It's Rhodey's Mark II, if you like. And the War Machine is still somewhere gathering dust and Tony's somehow got his hands on it or something, you know. But it wouldn't have taken much to do, just drop a couple of lines here or there, and then he can get War Machine back at the end. You can still have the gag with Tony saying, oh, they're not coded to you, sorry, you know, and Rhodey looks crestfallen, and then he turns around and his old friend is waiting for him, and it just would have been great. To be honest, in all three of those movies, more War Machine is something I would have done, as much as I love them all. He's great. Okay. The next thing is the Mandarin. Of course, the cause of many a fight upon the interweb, and probably in the boardrooms at Marvel when Shane Black and Drew Pearce came in and said, "You know what we want to do?" But fair play to them. I thought the fake-out with the Mandarin was brilliant. The twist was hilarious. At the time, I was angry. Benji will remember. I was fuming in the cinema, but by the time I'd driven home and calmed down, I thought, you know what? They got me. I think a lot of people who were upset about it were mostly upset just at having the rug pulled out from under them. I don't think it was as much a great love of the Mandarin character as some people might see, because the character, although he's, you know, Iron Man's greatest villain, he's been around for decades. I don't mean to smack-talk Iron Man's Joker, and I know I'm going to get a lot of heat for this, but he is, you know, basically, he's a racist caricature. He's very over the top, he's very silly, even in a universe that contains villains like Fin Fang Foom. I'm total picking on Iron Man villains here, don't I? But, I don't think there were many of us that were sort of crying out for the proper comics Mandarin to get done in the movies, because, you know, the movie would get banned in several territories for a start. You know, the big Chinese market that Marvel desperately need to keep getting these things over the billion mark, that wouldn't have happened. I think people were upset, A, that we had the rug pulled out from under us, and B, that not that we didn't get the classic Mandarin, that we didn't get the awesome Ben Kingsley Mandarin that the trailer sold us. That's what we missed. And my feeling is that we can only be so angry about that because the people we're angry with are the same people who gave us that version of the Mandarin anyway. We were only sold the Osama bin Mandarin with the express intention of the rug pull happening and Trevor Slattery happening. So you can't really blame the writers too much for that. However, we thought of a way that we could have our cake and eat it with the Mandarin, which is very simple. It's actually just follow up on a line that Ben Kingsley has in the film, which is when he's rattling off all the things that Guy Pearce, Aldrich Killian, and co have done to him to persuade him to play this part. They've given him the mansion, they've given him a boat, a nice one, and all the ladies and all the drugs he wants. And he says, "They gave me some plastic surgery." And now, ostensibly, the reason for the plastic surgery is so that he doesn't look like Trevor Slattery anymore, so that when the Mandarin videos start going viral, Trevor's mum in Croydon isn't going, "That's my boy!" and phoning the FBI and tipping them off. SHIELD, sorry, FBI. that's the essential reason for the line about plastic surgery. But could it be that he got plastic surgery not just so that he didn't look like Trevor, but that he did look like the Mandarin, who is a real force and was behind things all along, and Trevor's merely the fall guy. Trevor's the guy who can get arrested and go to jail and look like the guy from these videos, whilst the real mastermind is still out there wearing some Chitauri rings that he'd scavenged from the Battle of New York. And there you go, you've got a hybrid of Osama bin Mandarin, comic 10 rings powered Mandarin. Boom, ready for Iron Man 4 or Avengers 3 or whenever you want to use him. The final thing we do, tiny fix, I'm not even sure I want this. I've written it, I've thought about it, but even now I'm going to question my judgement on it. And that is, should there be any clearing up of the whether he's retired issue at the end? A lot of people are saying, how's he going to be in Avengers 2 and 3 when he's not Iron Man anymore? Is he just going to be designing stuff and not actually going and fighting them? Is Ultron going to be an AI-powered Iron Man suit that then goes renegade? What is it? So I just said, you know, if he made it clear that what he promises Pepper at the end is that the obsession will stop. Not the suits, but the obsession with the suits. He blows up the 40-odd that he's got. He's going to build one more and just have one suit at a time. Iron Man will still be on watch, but it'll no longer be all about, you know, all that Tony thinks about. That's what I took from it anyway, that's what he's promising Pepper. But the film does kind of, a lot of people were like, it's probably because Dark Knight Rises came out the year before. People are like, "Oh, right, he's not Iron Man anymore, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is." So, you know, could we maybe have had a line of dialogue to clear it up? But to be honest, he says it at the end. The original ending, the line in the fade to black, was apparently going to be, "Who am I? I am Tony Stark." And it was going to be a mirror to the end of Iron Man 1. And then at the last minute, I can't remember if it was Shane Black or Drew Pearce, but one of them decided to change it. And what we got was, "Who am I? I am Iron Man." So instead of opposing the end of Iron Man 1, he repeats it, but with more meaning because of what he's gone through in the other films. So I think that pretty much clears up. He's still Iron Man. So actually, yeah, they didn't need to change that. We'll leave that. So There you go. Iron Man 3. Fixed. Start filming and turn back.
That's right. Okay, rolling.
My name is John. Star Trek Into Darkness, or Star Trek Into Darkness, or however you want to pronounce it without the colon. Second big tentpole movie of 2013. Brilliant movie. We'll probably do a Star Trek podcast at some point, because we're both big fans of Star Trek, Ben probably more so than me. And particularly this one, we mostly agree on this one. I think we both thought it was a good movie, enjoyed it. I loved it. Benji has issues with it, so look out for that in the near future. But we agree certainly on how it could have been fixed. Whether the disagreement is on the quality of what we got, but not where the problems lie. So, how to fix Star Trek Into Darkness? If you haven't seen it yet, see it. Again, spoiler warning. It's really good. Great fun action movie. If it wasn't called Star Trek, I think Benji would agree with me that it's a really good movie. It is, you know, fun space adventure. Because it's called Star Trek, it comes with a certain obligation, I would say, to sort of live up to its forebears. And this is the crux of the matter. Star Trek Into Darkness very famously chose to take the villain and a few plot elements from Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and present them in a new, updated, and not necessarily improved way. So, therein lies pretty much everything we would fix about it. Just going to refer to my notes quickly here. Cut this out in post. Right, so, yeah, the biggest thing to fix is Khan. Why is he Khan? He didn't need to be Khan. I think they wanted a physical threat. They wanted somebody who could fight everyone. Great, you know, there's lots of villains you could have used, or you could have created a new one. I like the idea that they settled on the eugenics supermen, of which Khan is one. But yeah, he didn't need to be Khan, especially when you cast... Decent actor though he is, you cast a lily white guy like Benedict Cumberbatch, a very, very English-sounding gentleman, as a guy whose name is Khan Noonien Singh. And they can't even say it's just Khan, because Leonard Nimoy drops the Noonien Singh in the middle of the film. So, why is he Khan? Why is he Khan? I think it's just done because Wrath of Khan's everyone's favourite Star Trek. So, you know, yeah. This is, you know, the last time we did Star Trek 2, it was Wrath of Khan, and everyone loved that. So this is Star Trek 2 in the new timeline, but I prefer to think of it as Star Trek 12. I think that was the reason behind it. He could easily have been John Harrison. That could have been his real name, not a pseudonym. Or he could have had another name, like Gleeble Farp, and John Harrison's still a pseudonym, and he's not then Khan. You know, it could have been anything. It didn't need to be Khan, and the film would have been largely the same. Why? Because Khan, one of the main things that makes Khan compelling, and I'm basing this on Wrath of Khan, not Space Seed, because if I have seen it, it was when I was knee-high, and I don't remember it very well. Benji will correct me at some point in the future if I get anything wrong. But one of the things that makes Khan compelling, one of the things we loved about Wrath of Khan, was just how much he hates Kirk. And just, you know, how much Kirk hates him when he's gone, you know. There's real venom there. And in this film, they meet for the first time. And to be honest, Kirk treats him fairly well. He smacks him about for ages at the start, but it barely makes a dent because Khan's a Superman. And in Kirk's defence, you know, Khan killed his friend and mentor. So, you know, I'm sure Khan would agree that Kirk kind of had a leg to stand on, or seven, when he was punching him. So there's no reason for Khan to hate Kirk anything near as much as Ricardo Montalban's Khan hated William Shatner's Kirk. And on the flip side, Yeah, Kirk has a good enough reason, and losing Chris Pike, he has a good enough reason to hate Khan. But still, it's one-sided again. So, right from the bat, I'm not going to care as much about this Kirk and Khan conflict as I am the original one. Because this Khan hasn't got a reason to hate Kirk. At the end of the movie, he's got a reason to hate Spock, because he thinks Spock's blown up all his people. But, again, you know. So, how do you get around it? You just make him not Khan. He's a new adversary they're meeting for the first time. And his beef is with Robocop, as it is in the film. And that's it, and the rest could play out just as well, you know. Benedict Cumberbatch gives good bad guy. I agree with what Benji said in his retrospective. I don't think he's as good as the world at large seems to think he is. I don't think he's who we should all be fan-crushing on. But he's good enough. Smaug's great. I haven't seen much of the BBC Sherlock, but he looks like he's doing well in it. And I enjoyed him as Khan outside of the context of Khan. I enjoyed him as a super-powered guy who can chew the scenery up to tiny, tiny shreds in the middle of the film and then have a big punch-up with Zachary Quinto at the end. Fine. Great action movie sci-fi villain. Just call him something else, please. The other thing to fix... three more things I want to talk about. Two of them are very closely related, and they also relate back to the Khan thing, so we'll get those out of the... No, we'll not get those out of the way. We'll do the other thing first, and then we'll come back. So the other thing is this thing about launching torpedoes from the neutral zone into Kronos. Or Kronos. Or Klingon homeworld. Kronos, we're told in the film. I'll be honest with you, this one didn't wind me up very much when I was sitting in the movie. I didn't think about it, but Benji feels pretty strongly about it, so I want to bring this objection. And when it was explained to me, I completely agree, actually. This is something, if you're not a Trekkie, I don't think it's going to bother you. Or maybe if you're not a Trekkie, but if you're a Trekkie and or you have a sort of working knowledge of astrophysics, it'll bother you. The neutral zone that they talk about, parking on the edge of and firing things, is a very long way away from Kronos. Being able to aim one of these torpedoes with the kind of accuracy you would need to take out one man and no Klingons, thus avoiding interplanetary war, is impossible. It wouldn't happen. If the script demand, if the plot, if it was the only thing that made sense, I think it's the kind of thing that even a hardcore Trekkie could make their peace with. But that's the crux. It didn't depend on it. It could have been anything. They didn't need to. They could have been sent to capture him and not kill him. You know, Robocop could have always planned on killing him when he was in custody. There are a million ways to write around it. You didn't need to write it in. And there's a few things like that with the science where it doesn't quite hold up throughout the film. It doesn't bother me. As I said, I'm not a scientist and I'm kind of a casual Trekkie. I'm a hanger-on or Trekkie. But I do. One thing I haven't known about Star Trek for a long time is the science has always, or traditionally, it's always been theoretically possible, not practically possible. But they've always tried to do science that makes sense in universe, if not in our universe, if you know what I mean. And the Abrams era, the two Abrams films, have taken a few liberties with that. And as I say, to the blissfully ignorant, not a problem, but I can understand absolutely why it winds up people. It's one of the things that separates Star Trek from Star Wars, from Firefly, from Battlestar Galactica, from things like that, is that it's taken the science aspect of science fiction a bit more seriously than the other shows have, and film series have. So, yeah, they should pay respect to that. How do we fix it? How do we get around it? Simple. He doesn't transport Beam to Kronos. He transports Beam to some random abandoned space station in the neutral zone. So there's his, you know, the neutral zone that everyone's meant to stay clear of, or at the very least, you know, use it sparingly, if my understanding is correct. So that's why it makes a good place to hide. He's not on Kronos. He's not on Earth. You know, it could be the space station that... I keep calling him Robocop, Peter Weller, Marcus, Admiral Marcus. It could be the space station where Marcus found him and his people in cryosleep. And he goes back there as his base of operations for his terror campaign against Starfleet. It's near enough to Kronos that when a Federation ship comes near it, so does a Klingon ship. They don't fire on each other, but when they're on the space station, the action sequence can kick off pretty much as it does. I love when he's got that big gun and he's taking down the little birds of prey left, right and centre, and then he leaps into it and he just wipes out about six Klingons in a second. That is cool action cinema and I don't want rid of that. But you can just change the locale, you know. Or it could be another random planet that's in the neutral zone, you know. It could be on planet, just not Kronos. And then and I know they wanted to write in the thing about Marcus trying to start the war, but again, Marcus... There were ways to write around that, you know. There were lots of ways to write around that. So I think we wrote ourselves into a black hole on that one. I say we. My name's Bob Orkey. So fix the science, take it seriously, don't muck about with torpedoes that are basically mini starships that can fly right down Khan's eye from the edge of the neutral zone. Please, thank you. Right, now that one's out of the way, these next two are connected and are also referenced back to Benedict Cumberbatch not being Khan. So the first one I want to tackle is Bones. Carl Urban is brilliant. We love Carl Urban. He's brilliant in everything. Even when he's in Drek, we like him. Do you know what? It's one of the best things in Chronicles of Riddick. Really good as Judge Dredd. Really good in Lord of the Rings. Really good when he's fighting Jason Bourne. Love him. Red. Love him in Red. So we like Carl Urban, and I think Carl Urban's Bones is terrific. He honours DeForest Kelly without copying him. He's got good chemistry with Chris Pine. He's got good chemistry with Zachary Quinto, which is difficult given that Zachary Quinto's playing such an emotionless being, apart from his temper tantrums, which are all in scenes of Bones. But, you know, he's really good. He is criminally underused in both of these films, particularly the second one, but even the first one. It's too much the Kirk and Spock show, and it should be about all three of them. Something I did this year, in the wake of Star Trek Into Darkness, because I loved it, was I went back, I borrowed from Benji the ones I didn't have, and I rewatched the ones I did have, and I watched the sort of the classic Star Trek films. And one of the many things I noticed about them that I hadn't remembered from seeing them when I was small was that on almost everyone, or I think everyone, certainly the majority, three names come up before the name of the film when the cast lists are rolling. Or certainly on the artwork, on the you know, when you get the little credits at the bottom of the poster, there are three names before Star Trek, whatever. And they are William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly. The three of them get top billing. Not the two of them, then everyone else. And that's something I think is missing from the new era, particularly when you've got an actor as good as Carl Urban. Bring Bones in more, give him more to do. The three-way relationship between those three is a really important thing. When you look at the start of Wrath of Khan, the early scenes in Wrath of Khan, where Kirk gets a visit from Spock and then a visit from McCoy, and they're giving him very different advice. And you know, the audience sit there smiling, thinking as soon as Spock goes, I can't remember, is it Spock first or Bones first, but as soon as one goes away, you're thinking, oh, here comes the other one, and sure enough it does, and they need to play that up more. So give Carl Urban more to do. This also would take care of my final grape, which is Khan's super blood. As a Deus Ex Machina, I don't mind it. The way it's fed to us by the script, however, I have a problem with. So I didn't mind the death scene, shamelessly aping Wrath of Khan, though it was. You know, the score's really good, the actors do well enough in the scene, it's a nice bit of the movie. Again, the way they bring Kirk back by using Khan's blood is fine, but the way the characters work it out, and that tribble that's practically, it must have been worse in 3D, it's practically winking at you from the front of the screen, when I'm injecting a dead tribble with Khan's blood. So, yeah, as a Deus Ex Machina, I didn't mind the super blood. It was a sensible way to bring Kirk back, and I didn't mind killing Kirk off. But yeah, it was stupid the way they figured it out. So what we could have done instead is, and this dovetails with giving Bones something to do, the little girl at the start, Noel Clark's daughter, who makes a miracle recovery because Khan gives his blood in exchange for getting Noel Clark to blow up London. That's a thread we can keep pulling at here. So in the briefing at the start, when Christopher Pike gets taken out, they can say something about the he was pressed into doing it by this man, John Harrison, and they can talk. Somebody can ask the question about the family: why did so and so turn on us? Oh, well, Khan blackmailed him using his daughter's illness, and so on and so forth. And you know, somebody can raise the question: how did Khan make his daughter better? And Bones can sort of pick that. Bones, the detective, can go and start picking away at that, take samples of the girl's blood or something like that. Then that gives you a few more. Okay, you have to add to the running time, but you can trim fat in other places. Bones has this recurring thing of he's constantly trying to figure out how this little girl got better throughout the movie. It gives him more dialogue scenes with Kirk, more dialogue scenes with Spock, who's maybe questioning the logic of following it up when it's... logically, it doesn't matter anymore. The important thing is Khan is a threat, or not Khan is a threat, and we need to deal with him. And that sets up some great McCoy and Spock antagonism, which is always a good thing, you know. Then he figures it out, right when he needs to. It's Khan's blood. We need Khan alive. And thus you get the satisfying conclusion that Bones has used his theory that he's worked out, even though the ever-logical Spock would have told him to abandon it, to save their mutual friend whose death has enraged the ever-logical Spock to such a degree that he's about to beat to death the man that they need to keep alive to save. And there you go. Makes Bones relevant, gives him something to do, gives him a little boo-boo over Spock. Makes Spock grateful for Bones, because Spock wants Kirk back, you know. And there you go, that's that. There's also, Benji and I have talked about this a lot, and in fact I'd really appreciate, we both would really appreciate some feedback in the comments, how you feel about this. About the actual death scene itself, we have both had conflicting theories. We said it was kind of obvious that it would be Kirk that would die. As soon as that trailer came out with the hands on the glass, and, you know, after months and months of them saying it's not Khan, we knew it was going to be Khan. So we thought, yeah, somebody's going to die. And the obvious choice is, well, flip it. Kirk dies instead of Spock. But I said, well, why doesn't Bones die? I know I've just said all this stuff about how Bones needs to figure it out, and I would need to do some more work to make it work. Maybe he figures it out, leaves it with Alice Eve, and then Alice Eve uses it to bring Bones back to something. I said, Bones dies, because nobody's expecting that. He wasn't involved in the original death. Well, he was in the death scene, he was standing aside, but he wasn't, you know, either of the hands pressing against the glass in Wrath of Khan, so that would be the surprise. Benji said, Spock dies. It's a double bluff. You know, if you're going to copy Wrath of Khan, copy Wrath of Khan. It happens in a slightly different way for different reasons, but it carries the same emotional weight as when it did with Leonard Nimoy, and that's what people won't be expecting. They'll be expecting it to be anyone but Spock. So, wham! No, it is Spock. What do you think? Tell us. Should it have been Kirk? Should it have been Spock? Should it have been Bones? Should it have been Uhura? Should it have been none of them? Should it have been Khan himself, sacrificing himself at the end of the film to undo his own damage? Tell us what you thought. Could it be Arnold Schwarzenegger slowly doing a thumbs up? I don't know. So, boom. Star Trek Into Darkness, almost fixed, pending audience reaction. Right. Man of Steel. Man of Steel, 2013's DC effort, Superman. Oh, how I looked forward to this film. And oh, how, in fairness, I enjoyed it very much in the cinema at the time, as did Benji. And then it took us varying amounts of time to start thinking about it and start questioning it. Frustrating, I think, is the word. It gets a lot right. It does get a lot good, but there's a lot for us to fix. So let's wade straight in and fix it. Well, where to begin? There's lots of places to begin. I'm trying to think, maybe probably narratively, we'll begin at the beginning of the film. Russell Crowe. Russell Crowe. Right? I don't mean take him out of the film. To be honest, for the most part, I thought his performance was fine. Not great, far from his best, serviceable. Not as good as Marlon Brando's Jor-El, but was it going to be? But it did what we needed for the film, for the most part. But the changes made to the script to placate Russell Crowe's enormous ego, to make Jor-El Jor-El Decimus Meridius, when the script tells us that Krypton scientists are bred to be scientists, and Krypton soldiers are bred to be soldiers, and Krypton ice cream makers are bred to be ice cream makers. The script tells us this. They're all restricted by their genes. A role is selected for them by society. The Codex makes them genetically suited to that task, and that's all they can do. The whole point is that Kal-El is special because he's born rather than made, and he's not restricted to any of these things, and that's what makes him the Superman or the Super Kryptonian. But it means your most badass soldier, your General Zod, can lose in a fight to the lab coat guy because the lab coat guy is played by Gladiator. It makes no sense. Pick one and stick to it. If Marlon Brando's Jor-El had kicked the mince out of Terrence Stamp, I wouldn't have an issue. Wouldn't have made any sense, but the script doesn't say anywhere that Jor-El can't have Zod. This script does, and then immediately refutes it. Stupid. Why was it done? Because Russell Crowe likes to be an action hero. He's like, Zek, I've noticed I'm not kicking anyone's ass. Zach's like, no, Russell, you're his dad. You're not the star. Yeah, but I need to kick someone's ass. No, Russell, and then cut to 10 minutes later, Zack Snyder's got a phone-shaped imprint on his face. So we're going to have Russell beat up Michael. And that's what happens. Stupid, no, don't do it. Same for the two big Olympic dives that he does. Why? He could have just got off the dragon and jumped in the water. Why is it even in water? You know, I loved the Krypton sequence. The design of Krypton was awesome. I even liked Russell Crowe flying through on a space dragon. There's nothing in the script that says Krypton scientists can't have space dragons. So fine, go with it. go nuts. The sequence itself was cool. Krypton erupting into war, all the costumes, the armour, I saw the set photos and they looked stupid. Even worse than Captain America's Avengers costume did. And then in the final product, just like Captain America's Avengers costume, it looked really good. So the design of it, I don't have an issue with. And most of the way it plays out, I don't have an issue with. It's just this Jor-El as an action hero nonsense. Get rid of it. The plot would have been exactly the same. Take the fight. So after wiping out about 9 of Zod's dudes with some equilibrium gun-fu, and then 2 more in the room where he's about to fire Kal-El up in space, he has a fight with Zod. Jor-El beats Zod. Lara launches Kal into space. Zod kills Jor-El. The rest of the film happens. Now, in Malcolm Benji's version, Jor-El has a fight with Zod because he's trying to protect his wife and son. Zod easily overpowers him and kills him. Lara still launches Clark into space, Kal, into space before Zod can do anything about it, and the rest of the film plays out as we saw. How is that different? Answer, we've not contradicted the bit about Jor-El not being a soldier. So it's better. It is better, no matter what Russell or his agent or anyone say, it is better. It's simpler, you're not taken out of the movie straight away by a stupid contrivance. It's better. Russell Crowe, wisen up. You're really good when you want to be. Just be that guy again. Sorry. Right. Next thing. Destruction. A lot's been made about the destruction in Man of Steel, of Smallville and later of Metropolis. I'm going to say something that's controversial to both camps. Both the anti-destruction and the pro-destruction people are going to fall out with me here. I would certainly get rid of or tone down the destruction of Metropolis at the end of the film. I think that was definitely overdone, so sorry pro-destruction guys. But yeah, it was too much of it, it went on too long, it distracted you from the plot. There's no need for it, it was just because Transformers 3 and Avengers Assemble made $1 billion, so they're like, right, we need a city blowing up. Stupid. And I mean, to be honest, if you're making amendments to your script because Transformers 3 made money, you've got serious problems, okay? And if you think Avengers made money just because New York blew up, you've also got serious problems. But anyway, so I would get rid of Metropolis. However, the destruction of Smallville, I would keep. The change I would make there is not, as some have suggested, that Clark shouldn't take the fight there, because he does. Zod's picking on Martha Kent. And Clark comes in out of the left field, grabs Zod, and flies him into the town, and then they fight in Smallville High Street and destroy it. And a lot of people said Clark wouldn't do that, he shouldn't do that. But you know, it's a mistake. It's Superman Begins, it's not the Man of Steel Returns. So I can live with him making a few mistakes. And the reason I would leave it in is this. When he steps out from behind that train after the fight, after all the devastation that's been caused to Smallville, largely because Clark took the fight there inadvertently, and he steps out and the soldiers are all pointing guns at him and him out of Law and Order says, oh no, he's one of us. Instead of that, have Clark look around at his hometown, because it is his hometown, although he's an alien, and although the film skipped, you know, from his crash landing to his adulthood fairly quickly. You know, he grew up there. We get plenty of flashback sequences. We know he grew up there. Plus, we've heard of Superman. We know he grew up on Earth, you know. It is his hometown. Have him look around at the destruction he's caused and be upset by it. Have some consequence. That's the problem with the destruction in this film. It's not that it happens. It's that nobody seems to care. There doesn't seem to be any consequence about it. Even Avengers has this shot of Cap looking around at what's happening, and it's not Cap's fault, but he still feels bad about it, because that's how good a guy he is. And Superman's that good a guy. I mean, they're one another's mirror in the two big comic companies, you know. So, yeah, have Superman look around and have this, oh my god, what have I done moment, and that makes him even more determined at the end to stop Zod trashing Metropolis, take Zod away from Metropolis and make him pay. You know, that's it, you set it up there. And instead, it's like, yeah, neither Superman nor the soldiers care about the destruction. They just care that he saved a couple of soldiers during it, so he's earned their trust, and we can now move along to the next plot element. Stupid. So there we go. Keep Smallville getting trashed, but have it be of consequence. It upsets Superman that he let this happen. He vows never to let it happen again. Sets up plot elements for sequels as well. Luther Corner in town cleaning up Smallville after what Superman did to it. Boom. Done. Luther Corner. They're not... It's not Luther Corps. They're not military. Luther Corp. Corporation. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, that. Lois Lane. I love Amy Adams. I really do. There's not much I would change there. I know I'm not as diehard a Superman fan as I am some other comics, so I've not read as much as I should have. I've read a lot of the big things. I thought her Lois was did well enough. She was smart, she was tough, she spoke back to the men, which wasn't overbearing. She wasn't too damsel in distress either, there were a couple of moments. But by and large, the performance I thought was great. But some of the things the script did with her was a bit bizarre. It was a bit like, we need to get Lois up onto Zod's ship so that her and Russell Crowe can figure out the answer. Because if I get the point that if I don't know if anyone's seen the How It Should Have Ended for Man of Steel, but it's really funny. Watch it. Watch all those videos. They're great. But, yeah, it's almost like they said in the How It Should Have Ended, I won't tell you how it goes, but in order to avoid how that goes, they're like, we need somebody else to figure out how to save the day. Superman can't learn it too soon, otherwise the film's over. So I understand why it needed to be Russell Crowe imparting it to Amy Adams, who then imparts it to Henry Cavill. Fine. But why, when Zod turns up and goes, give us Kal-El! So Kal-El gives them Kal-El, and then Zod goes, right, we want the redhead too! Why? Stupid. Instead, Superman's off either making his way back to Russell Crowe for some advice, or that scene where he goes and sees the random priest in the middle of the movie. He's not given himself up yet. He's not made the decision to turn himself over to the humans. While this is happening, Zod's still looking for him. He's made his threats and he wants them to hand over Kal-El, but he's not resting on his laurels. He's scanning the internet for mentions of him. And of course, earlier in the film, we had that guy, that other reporter that Lois leaks her story to because Perry White won't publish it. He says on the news, Lois Lane knows who this guy is. Lois Lane, talk to her. That's why the FBI pick her up in the first place. Fine. So then we get Zod and Not Ursa and Not Non storming the FBI place, taking Lois because they know she knows who Kal-El is. And then whether he knows she's there or not, that could be the kick up the arse he needs to become Superman, or the conversation with the priest, whatever. But that's when he goes to Zod's ship to rescue her, not just randomly. I know that kind of flies in the face of the damsel in distress thing I was saying earlier, but I think it organically sets up, it gives Zod a sensible reason to have Lois on the ship, rather than if he's already got his prize, why does Lois mean anything to Zod? She doesn't. She would only ever have meant something to him as a way to get Kal-El, so use it. This guy needed more to do. More to do, is that fair? No, he's really good. He's really, really good, Kevin Costner. Very pleasantly surprised. Best Robin Hood? Probably. Best Robin Hood in this film? Certainly. Even if the animated fox had been in it. Best Superman's dad? Yeah. And I'm even including all the Jor-Els in that. Even Brando. No. Kevin Costner's Jonathan Kent. Loved it. I could have done with him appearing once more. The film was quite laden with flashbacks and sort of non-linear timing and both father figures speaking to him a lot. But I would have liked a callback. I would have liked the thing when he's lying on the beach after he flies through the gravity machine and he lies on the beach and he reaches out to the sun. I was waiting for a memory or a vision or an Obi-Wan Kenobi ghost of Kevin Costner to appear or something, and it didn't happen, and I think it should have. Just a bit of sort of payoff. A bit where he could finally say to him, you know, be whatever you want to be. Be the opposite of the Krypton society you're pigeonholed. Which I suppose is kind of Russell Crowe's job, but I'm just angry with Russell Crowe in this movie. And I love Kevin Costner so much. So, but yeah, I would have liked a bit more of Jonathan Kent. Something at a pivotal moment. Either then when he's lying on the beach, or during the fight with Zod. If he gets, like in Rocky 3, when Clubber Lang's just poning Rocky, and then Rocky remembers Mickey, and he gets up and, you know, wins. And it's awesome. Like that, when Zod's absolutely owning Clark, and then he remembers Kevin Costner. Who's his proper dad? Genetics be damned. Jor-El, fair, as far as absentee fathers go, he's got a good reason. He got blown up on a planet that went Nova. Yeah, fair enough. But he's still an absentee father.
Jonathan Kent put the work in. You know, he's what made him Clark Kent. He's what made him the good, noble, honourable man that he is. And then Jor-El just filled him in on his heritage and his history, and it turns out he would have made him a noble man too, but still Jonathan Kent. So Jonathan Kent should have said something inspirational or wonderful, and then that's when Clark gets up and starts fighting back and beats Zod, and that would have been awesome. So yeah, a little more Jonathan Kent positioned, used with sniper accuracy at a pivotal moment towards the end of the film would have been nice. Thank you. Next, the fight was odd at the end. We've touched on it already. I said we should keep the destruction of Smallville but tone down the destruction of Metropolis for two reasons. One, again, it was kind of over the top. There's a lot of innocents died there, and I know it's Superman Begins and he's still learning and all of that, and that's fine. That's a good in-universe explanation for why he allows it to happen, but why did the writers make it happen? You know, it's not really palatable for the audience to watch Superman let that many people die. And I don't think Zack Snyder and Dave Goyer and Jonah Nolan thought about it that much, but therein lies the problem. You know, I don't think they were thinking loads of people died in this scene, but they should have thought about that. So tone it down a bit. Have him, you know, he starts fighting Zod in the crater where the ship crashes. That's fine. I like the idea of Zod wanting to kill this man who's just eradicated his species in the graveyard of his species. That ship was Zod's last hope for restoring Krypton. Clark crashes the ship and breaks the Genesis chamber. So Zod's there in the wreckage picking up the dust. So this is all that's left of my race, you little bastard. And he takes a fight to him. That's really cool. And then you have Clark, who's haunted by what happened to Smallville earlier, takes him up to space. We get the cameo from the Bruce Wayne satellite. And they land somewhere. Up in the Arctic, where the Fortress of Solitude was, somewhere, I don't know, somewhere away from civilization. Or they stay in Metropolis, but they just do less throwing each other through buildings. You know, Clark keeps the fight near Zod. I don't know. I don't know exactly what I wanted, but what we got, even the first viewing in the cinema, by the time he got spun round by the cape and flung through that multi-story car park sideways, I was thinking, how many walls has he gone through? So if I'm thinking about it then, when I'm that excited about seeing the first Superman movie in 7 years. 7 years? 7 years. I think it's a problem. Also, the slow motion. Zack Snyder gets picked on for overusing slow-mo a lot. Probably justifiably so. Certainly in Sucker Punch, although I really liked Sucker Punch visually. There's a lot of slow-mo shots. There's none in this, which a lot of people would have been relieved by. They'd have gone, yes, he's finally listened, he's stopped doing the slow-mo. I just said, when you've got characters that can move as fast as Kal-El and Zod, being witnessed by characters who move as slowly as, or as comparatively slowly as Lois Lane and Perry White, surely that's a good chance to move slow-mo. What I'd have dearly liked to see, not for the entire fight, but one sequence where the background is going really slow and Henry Cavill and Michael Shannon are fighting each other real time. So it's not slow-mo in the traditional sense. It's not a completely slow-motion shot. They're fighting each other, just two actors on a green screen soundstage in costume, stage fighting. And then we superimpose the background with computers, but the background's going really slowly. And then you've got the Zack Snyder signature slow-mo, but it makes sense in the context of the character, Superman moving really fast. And crucially, instead of, you know, tiny digital Zod in the middle of the shot, flinging tiny digital Clark through massive digital building, you've got Michael Shannon and Henry Cavill's faces, voices, expression, acting in the middle of a fight. That's what I'd rather see. I sound like a total hypocrite saying that. I was one of these people that was angry with Superman Returns for the lack of action. Said, you're finally making a Superman movie in the digital stunt double era when you could have Superman chucking Darkseid or Doomsday or Zod through buildings. And you've not done it. How dare you? So I'm totally just being a spoilt child now and saying to Zack Snyder, we finally got that, but just tone it down a bit. To be honest, those shots that were in the trailer of him punching Zod and then flying up to catch up and punching him again, that's exactly what I wanted from the Superman movie. And we got that, and then we got a further 20 minutes of fight, which we didn't need. It's a bit like the fight at the end of Incredible Hulk, which was touted as being 25 minutes long, and it's nothing like it. But on reflection, it's a good thing that it's nothing like it. To be honest, it was dragging on a bit in the 5-10 minutes we got. And this is the same. There is such a thing as too much, even in superhero smackdowns. Yeah, so that. I think that might be it for Man of Steel. Yeah, Man of Steel, hopefully, fixed.
Pacific Rim. Yeah. This is a... what's the word? A bit of an anomaly, Pacific Rim. In fact, I love and hate it for one thing it did, which was it... I feel like Pacific Rim is the film that the Transformers movies should have been, or wish they were. That kind of dumb, fun, giant robots doesn't make a lick of sense, but you can let it off because it's kind of awesome. Whereas Transformers is dumb, giant robots doesn't make a lick of sense. So, yeah, there's that that I like about it. But then also, as somebody who can take or leave Gypsy Danger, having never heard of it before the film was being touted, and somebody who's a big fan of Optimus Prime, I'm also like, well, you were better than Optimus Prime's film, and that's annoying. But, you know, it's Michael Bay's fault. It's not Guillermo del Toro's. Pacific Rim, I enjoyed it. It was good, but it needs fixing. So let's fix it. First thing, most important thing to do with Pacific Rim, take out the science, take out the explaining stuff. Talked about Star Trek, and we said how Star Trek always took the science part of its science fiction very seriously, and that's something that J.J. Abrams' Trek should have done more. And I stand by that. This Pacific Rim is silly enough, and, you know, big giant robots, big giant aliens enough, that I would say tone down the science part of your science fiction and sort of ramp up the fantasy element. It's sci-fi, not fantasy, but I mean the fantasy in the sense of escapism. I love it when it's a giant robot punching a giant monster. All the fights are really well shot, really well choreographed. Again, even the things that don't make sense, like the sword's really effective, so why did you wait 10 minutes into the fight before you whipped out the sword? Because it looks awesome, and that's fine. But this is in the same film where you try and saddle it with a lot of sort of pathos on the character stuff, and a lot of exposition, a lot of backstory in the science. You know, the human mind can't operate the Jaeger, and you need to have two of you, and you need to be compatible, and you have to go into one another's memories. And there was an idea that I read about that was in one version of the script that they eventually got out, that was that Mako, I want to say Mako, or Miko, it might be Miko, her and Charlie Hunnam are co-piloting the Jaeger, and there was this idea in the script that she doesn't speak any English and he doesn't speak any Japanese at the beginning of the film, and that they're sort of subtitled and translated for the audience and for one another. And by the end of the film, through them having had a few adventures in the Jaeger and the mind meld, he starts hearing her in English and she starts hearing him in Japanese. And they scrapped that. And in another film, that might have been quite a neat idea, but that's exactly the kind of thing. I'm glad they scrapped that, and I wish they'd scrapped more, because the silly bits were too silly and the sciencey bits were too sciencey to coexist in the same film. So pick one and go with it. And given how much fun those big fights were, and given how outlandish and ridiculous the premise is, play to the ridiculous strengths is what I'm saying here, Guillermo. That's what you should have done. The science behind the Jaegers is way too much. Didn't need to be two pilots. The audience would have accepted one dude in a kind of awesome suit-looking thing, and he moves his arm, and the Jaeger's arm moves. Okay, if we're accepting that there's a tear in the Pacific Rim and aliens are coming through it, we're accepting that a robot that big can respond that quickly to Charlie Hunnam or whoever moving their arm. It's a non-issue. By trying to explain it too much with the science, you've created an issue. By making us think about it, we'll think about it to the degree that the science that's in the film falls apart. By just accepting, right, there's big robots and we can pilot them and they're awesome. You go with that, it's fine. It's the Michael Bay defence that actually works, where ironically it doesn't work for Michael Bay films. So, you know, you should have run with it. So yeah, take out the science. Which also sets me up for... take out Charlie Day, Bern Gorman, and I'll come back to Ron Perlman. I quite like Charlie Day in Always Sunny. I quite like Bern Gorman in Torchwood. I like Ron Perlman in a lot of things. What's that subplot doing? What? It's distracting. This could have been a 90-minute action-adventure romp. I would have loved it. As it was an awesome-looking movie that I quite enjoyed. So, yeah. Right, cut this bit out. I'm going to try and riff, and I think I can finish Pacific Rim pretty quickly, to be honest. So, again, we'll do some editing. Flash up at Charlie Hunnam. Charlie Hunnam. Get rid of him. I love Sons of Anarchy. I really do. He's not brilliant in it, but he's solid enough. He carries the show. He's got a lot of good actors around him that are doing as much of the heavy lifting as he is. He's not good enough in this. And worse, he doesn't need to be in this. So I'd maybe be more inclined to let him off if he was essential. But what's his name? Raleigh? Raleigh. Isn't essential to the film. The film works just as well if Miko Mako, I keep getting her name wrong, but if she's the lead, it's a young girl trying to prove herself to her mentor, Idris Elba, and make it in the traditionally male-dominated world of Jaeger piloting, set against the backdrop of this epic humanity versus kaiju tale. Boom. Done. Film. Sorted. Love it. So yeah, just get rid of Charlie Hunnam. He's doing nothing there besides his accent wibbles sometimes in Sons of Anarchy, but it's all over the shop in this. Yeah, ridiculous. Anyway. So yeah, get rid of Hunnam. He's doing nothing. One pilot per Jaeger, I talked about that already. I'll take that out. Done that. Yeah, so the last thing I would like to get rid of is there's these two kind of jock douche antagonist pilots that were clearly originally written to be British. They're both played by English actors. They wear sort of classic World War II flight pilot gear. And they have a pet bulldog. They were sort of tally-ho, kind of Anglo-American rivalry type thing, until somebody at some stage, after casting and principal photography, went, hang on, Britain's not on the Pacific, why would they have a Jaeger team? So at the last minute they got rewritten to be Australians, or Brit-Australians, as I like to say. The two actors, the older guy's not bad, but he really struggles with the accent. The younger guy is bad, and he really struggles with the accent. If you're going to make him Australian, cast Australian actors. There's tons of good Australian actors. And there's certainly tons of Australian actors good enough to handle these relatively small parts. They're not carrying the movie, you know. Could have easily been done. However, what I would have done is get rid of them entirely. Ron Perlman. Ron Perlman's great. He should be in lots of things, and I love that he's in all Del Toro's American movies. And I would like that to continue. I'd have been disappointed if Ron Perlman wasn't in Pacific Rim. Didn't like the character we got. I certainly didn't like his payoff in the end credits scene. Stupid, like, where's my goddamn shoe? As if, no matter how absurd the universe you live in, that's what you're worried about when you've sliced your way out of an alien monster's belly. Where's my freaking shoe? No, stupid. But he needed to be in the film somewhere, just to keep the Del Toro Perlman shippers happy. I'm one of those. So make him the jock douchebag pilot. He was rivals with Idris Elba in Jaeger school when they were younger. He's grown up bitter and angry. He takes out on Idris Elba's adopted daughter, Miko Mako. She one-ups him and saves his life, much as she does, much as Raleigh and her do in the final film to the Brit-Australian guys. Boom, yeah, there's Ron Perlman. He can go down in the blaze of glory, as Ron Perlman's very good at doing. Yeah, I'd watch that. Love that. Ron Perlman gives good asshole. Let him do it. Yeah, done. There you go. Pacific Rim fixed.
Watch it again.
Yeah, it's a robot. I know, right? Yep, that's what I said. The Wolverine. Almost. Yeah, the Wolverine was a bit hit and miss for me, as you may have gleaned. Really glad Wolverine finally got a solo movie. Been waiting for that since 2003, so it's good that they finally made one. One. Just the one. Yeah, it was nearly really good. Very nearly, arguably, the best X-Men movie since X2. And possibly the best Marvel movie of 2013, if it had been fixed. Maybe not, that's a bold statement, but it was that close. I feel that strongly about it. So what would we do to fix the Wolverine? First thing, and this is a problem right through the movie, most of my criticisms are aimed at the last third, but this is a problem from the beginning. Viper,
Get rid of her. Why is she even in it? A, it's not Viper. I don't know what it is. I know it's going by the name Viper, but in the comics, for those of you that don't know, she's not a mutant. She's not blonde, although that's a minor complaint, but still. And she's certainly not a biogeneticist Dr. Hujit that makes Silver Samurai robots. She's a mercenary. She's a tough, bratty kind of, you know, kick-ass action chick, basically. And then she eventually climbs the ranks and she becomes the leader of Hydra. She becomes Madam Hydra. It gets a bit more sort of regal and sensible, but she's a villainess, and she's, you know, really good with hand-to-hand combat and bombs and gadgets and stuff, but she's not a mutant. She certainly doesn't have a big serpentine tongue, and she can emit poisons that are so deadly they even hurt her. It's weird. If you're going to put her in the film, do her right. Didn't need to make her a mutant. One of the big selling points of the Japanese Wolverine story is that he's the only mutant in it. And then in this movie, they made Yukio and Viper mutants when they weren't. Yukio doesn't bother me because she's inoffensive, and her sort of future gimmick thing, seeing the death thing, doesn't really add anything to the film, but yeah, it gives her a sort of an air of mystique that I kind of like. But Viper's just dumb. So, jettison her from the script. There's a scientist who works for Yashida who's really good at this stuff. She's not consequential. That's how he builds the thing. That's all you needed. Boom, fixed. Right, the rest of the problems all begin in the final stretch. Two-thirds of that movie, Viper aside, is brilliant. The Japanese setting is brilliant. The decision to make it a sequel to X-Men 3 instead of a sequel to that other Wolverine movie that they didn't make. At the time, I wasn't convinced. I wanted the Japanese arc to take place before the X-Men movies, but seeing it in context, it makes sense. He's depressed after the ending of Last Stand, as were most of us. It makes sense to put Wolverine in that place, and it leads to a brilliant setup for Days of Future Past. So, yeah, well done. And like I say, Japan's brilliant. You get to see all sorts of different aspects of Japan. It's a bit cliche, maybe. You know, there's a temple, and then there's like sort of the Neo-Tokyo bit of stuff. But, you know, when it looks that good, when a country's that diverse and that interesting to look at, I think it's a good thing. And they do kind of check off all the boxes. You've got the idyllic kind of water garden house when they go to Nagasaki. You've got the sort of the imposing temple in the mountains and the funeral scene. You know, it's great. So, yeah, the scenery, the setting was brilliant, very well handled. The respect for the Japanese culture, I thought, was great as well. You know, most of the Japanese actors have most of their scenes in Japanese with subtitles. Very few scenes where they're forced to speak English for the Western audience, which I liked. There is one jarring one with Shingen and Yoshida speak to each other in English for no real reason when there's nobody else in the room, and they're both Japanese. But it's once in a 2-hour movie, and given the history of Hollywood films set in other parts of the world, it's actually a lot of restraint. But then you get to the end, and you've had all this beautiful setting and a good storyline, an actual script this time, which is nice. And then it just goes like a bit Thunderbirds-y, a bit sort of generic sci-fi ending. There's a mysterious lab in the middle of nowhere that could be anywhere. This big fight with Silver Samurai takes place in this nondescript, grey-walled lab that could have come straight out the end of the last Wolverine film. Why? So here's how I would fix it. First of all, Silver Samurai is not a giant robot. It's a normal-sized samurai suit. It can be, and in fact in me fixing it, it is mechanised. It is, it's been scienced up so that it's keeping Yoshida young inside it. Fine with that. They got that from Wolverine the night he stayed at the house before the funeral. They did something to him in his sleep. It wasn't Viper snogging him, because Viper's not in the movie. But, you know, say, you know, they hit him with a trank dart while he was already asleep so he wouldn't wake up, and then they extracted the healing factor somehow, fine. The Yakuza were supposed to run him off instead of kidnap Mariko, and then the rest of the movie can continue as normal. So they've got the healing factor, they've built this suit that keeps Yashida young, and that's what he's wearing when Wolverine arrives at the temple at the end. It's a normal sized suit, as I've said, so that there can be a stunt person inside it who can then have an awesome fight with Hugh Jackman. A choreographed two actors on a soundstage fight rather than Hugh Jackman reacting to ping pong balls. And it would look really good. We know the choreography is good because the fight Logan has with Shingen in the middle of the movie is one of the best fights in the cinema this year. Even better than Superman and Zod. So yeah, they have this epic fight, and everything else that happens can still be going on. So Harada can be sort of, to begin with, he's trying to help Yoshida, and then he realises Yoshida's evil and he sides with Logan, and he gets injured but not killed, because I'm going to come back to Harada. And crucially, the fight spills outside the lab. Instead of the whole fight happening in the lab, they crash through a wall at some point, and they're out on the snowy mountainside with the temple complex behind them and the village in front of them. So you've still got that nice Japanese imagery that's been present throughout the rest of the movie still happening at the end and the climax. Eventually, Logan, with or without help from Mariko, kills Yoshida. And because Harada was mortally wounded trying to save Wolverine, Wolverine feels like he owes him one. So they put the dying Harada into the Silver Samurai suit that was keeping Yoshida alive, so it keeps him alive. And that sets up a noble Silver Samurai called Harada, like he is in the comics, who can then be used in a Wolverine sequel or an X-Men sequel or a spin-off Silver Samurai movie or whatever. Boom. Done. More satisfying ending. For the audience, more visually stimulating ending. Silver Samurai is in the movie and actually becomes Silver Samurai, as opposed to putting him in the movie and having him be killed by this giant Iron Man imposter Silver Samurai. Yeah, there you go. Fixed. Thor, The Dark World. Really good sequel. Really enjoyed Thor 2. Liked it a lot. Improved on a lot of the problems with the first one, and brought in a lot of new stuff. It's really good. But it wasn't perfect, and we can fix it, and we will fix it. So the first thing I want to fix is the biggest cliché when he's talked to a Thor fan or a Thor hater about one of these movies is they'll always say there's too much stuff on Earth, not enough Asgard. But it's a cliché for a reason. It's true. The Earth stuff's really good. I really enjoyed a lot of the comic relief, more than I think I should. The film snob in me is like, don't laugh at Kat Dennings. Don't laugh at Stellan Skarsgård's arse. That's not funny. But it kind of was. So it's not that I hated the scenes on Earth, but I'd have happily jettisoned them for some more, not necessarily more Asgard, but more other realms. More Svartalfheim. Which brings me to the biggest thing I would change in the movie. Less Earth, more of the other realms, and make it more of a quest movie. It becomes a quest movie for about 20 minutes in the middle, when Thor busts Loki out of jail, and they go to Svartalfheim with Jane to draw Doctor Who and his cronies there. And it should have done that for a lot longer. Quest movies are awesome, there's not enough of them these days. When you've got a Marvel Cinematic Universe, and you've got all these different superheroes functioning, and they can come together and do the Avengers, and it's amazing. And you've got Iron Man and Captain America taking care of the more traditional superhero stuff. I mean, they're really the two superheroes out of the big four. You know, they've got a normal name and a superhero name, and they've got a costume, and they can suit up and get into adventures and stuff. Then you've got Hulk's like a guy who turns into a monster. That's a whole other realm of storytelling awesomeness there. But he's not a superhero per se. You know, he's not like Superman jumping into a phone booth and coming out as the Hulk, and you know. And Thor is the same. He's not a normal guy who turns into Thor. In some of the comics, yeah, but not in this version. He's this alien god thing, and he's got his whole sort of complex family life and all those problems and all the other realms and stuff. So, you know, he can be a superhero in the team-up movie about a bunch of superheroes on Earth, but when you're going back to his own movies, why not have more fun with the spacefaring, realm-trotting fantasy adventure side of it? So what I propose is make Svartalfheim a big part of the movie. Say the movie's 10% stuff on Earth, setting up Natalie Portman getting zapped by the thingy and, you know, Thor going to retrieve her and all that stuff. Maybe 20% Asgard, you know, the Dark Elves invasion, the stuff with Frigga, Periodically cutting back to Odin continuing to deal with the loss of his wife and wondering what his sons are up to, things like that, you know. And the other 70%, instead of going back to Earth, it's all in Svartalfheim. Or, you know, maybe a few realms, maybe they have to go through a couple of other realms. Loki's little sneaky path doesn't take them straight there, it takes them to Realm A, and then they have to go to Realm D before they finally get to Realm C, or something, you know. Just to make it a bit more interesting visually. But Svartalfheim could be laden with threats and things. They could have to fight through a cursed forest or, you know, a rocky crevice that's laden with giant frost beetles or something. You know, that there's so much stuff that you can do that you can just make up, just pull out of thin air, or you can take from the decades and decades of comics or borrow from the Norse myths that inspired the comics or whatever. And you could have done this really visually interesting, satisfying, you know, like the Never-Ending Story or something like that, but all marvelled up and big special effects and that, you know. Like the most obvious parallel, Lord of the Rings, like getting Jane to Svartalfheim's like getting the ring to Mount Doom, you know. They've got to get through Mirkwood, and they've got to get through Moria and things like that, you know. Do something like that, but Thor'd up. That would be a hell of a movie. Develop Malekith. Who was a bad guy in Thor 2? Loki. He wasn't really, he was a hero, but that's the problem. The only villain you remember from Thor 2 is actually the hero's sidekick, who's the reformed villain from the last two movies. I mean, Tom Hiddleston's great. He's better than Chris Eccleston. Chris Eccleston is better than I sometimes give it credit for, because I hate him because of Doctor Who. And that's unfair. It's unfair to his acting ability. As a person, Chris Eccleston, I'm very angry with you, and I think you should say sorry. But give him his due. He's done some good performances. He's fine. He's certainly capable to bring what a villain in these kinds of movies needs. And he doesn't. And I don't necessarily think it's his fault. I think it's the writing, to an extent, the direction, the editing. I think there's, from what I hear from interviews and things, there's a lot of Chris Eccleston on the cutting room floor in this film. The film was good fun anyway, but yeah, it does suffer when you had a Loki as Loki synonyms. When you had a villain as good as Loki in the first film, and as good as Loki in Avengers, and when you've had the villains like Jeff Bridges in Iron Man 1, Hugo Weaving in Captain America, and you know the villains by and large have been pretty awesome in these movies, and then you get to Malekith and he's just kind of meh. He's a walking plot device. He's a reason for the heroes to run from A to B. But I get no investment in him. I don't really know why he cares so much about turning the universe into darkness. You know, the coming of light really hurt the Dark Elves and thousands of them died because of it and he lost a family or something like that. I don't know. I don't know what his motivation is beyond he wants darkness. But why does he want darkness? And I just don't care about him. So when Thor's fighting him at the end, it looks awesome. They're jumping through portals and stuff. It's great. The costume's brilliant. I love the look of the Dark Elves. But I'm not going, yeah, when Thor beats him. I'm going, well, I expected Thor to beat him. And that's the thing. You know in these movies, especially when Chris Hemsworth's got a six-picture deal, you know Thor's going to win. The question isn't, is he going to win? It's, how is he going to win? And that's kind of interesting. But you also need to care. These kinds of things, not just Marvel, not just superhero movies, but these kind of sort of high adventure, good versus evil tales are always better when you really hate the villain and or really love the hero. And I didn't hate Malekith. I didn't care enough about him one way or the other to hate him. Curse was better. He killed Thor's mum, and I liked that it was Loki that took him out, and they played up that Loki was a bit of a mama's boy and he had a really good relationship with Frigga, and that's why Odin didn't execute him. And so Loki feels it as much as if not more than Thor when she dies, and then Loki is the one that gets to pull the trigger on Curse. I like that a lot. But that's the thing, Curse is the muscle. He's the, you know, he's, what's the example? He's like Bebop and Rocksteady to Malekith's Shredder. If you get that reference, you're showing your age. And yet, he was a far more credible lead villain than Shredder was. What's that about? That you know, no disrespect to Adewale and to the costume guys and everything. You know, Curse was brilliant. But if he's not the headline villain, then he shouldn't be the most memorable villain. And he is. So, yeah, Malekith needed some development. or maybe Thanos him. You know, Thanos is pulling the strings in the Avengers movie, but he's only in it for 2 seconds at the end. You don't see him. Loki's the focal point. So if you want, introduce Malekith unleashing curse on Asgard, and then let curse carry the movie as the villain, and Malekith's there for Thor 3, Thor 4, whenever you want to use him. One of those two things. Use him or lose him. That's what I'm saying for Malekith. Heimdall. More Heimdall, please. Idris Elba's brilliant, the costume looks brilliant, it's even better this time around, they've embellished it, it looks really sexy and awesome. He's used well in the first film, you know, you get that he's the gatekeeper, he can see things, they do some nice visual stuff with Thor's battle at the reclaiming the hammer and he can't lift it up, that's reflected in that Heimdall's eye, that's really cool. And I was really excited about the sequel because the bridge is broken at the end of the first one, so my mind went, in the second one, he's got nothing to guard. He's not tethered to the end of the bridge. He can come and get in an adventure with them and be awesome, be Idris Elba, lopping off bad dudes' heads left, right and centre. And we got a bit of that. He gets one action sequence where he takes down the Dark Elf ship and he gets a scene with Thor in the bar where he sort of says, I will help you escape. And then him helping him escape really just boils down to distracting Odin for 5 minutes. I would have liked to have seen a lot more of him. The supporting cast on Asgard were criminally underused in both these movies. I'm using Heimdall as a focal point, but this extends to Sif and the Warriors 3 as well. And again, I know there's concerns with screen time and running time and so on and so forth, but again, if we're excising a lot of this Kat Dennings and Stellan Skarsgård stuff, no disrespect to those two, but I would rather, if I had to pick between Thor's Earth homies and Thor's Asgard homies, after watching the first film, who did I want more of in the second film? It wasn't Kat Dennings and Stellan Skarsgård. It was the Asgard guys. Because they're different, they're more interesting. They're the warrior culture, they've got swords and armour and laser guns and it's awesome and it's different. You know, I've seen quirky girls with pithy one-liners and I've seen mad scientists before and they're awesome, they have their place, I enjoy them. But again, you know, you get enough of that from Iron Man. You'd Rebecca Hall and Gwyneth Paltrow and Iron Man had a few zingers and got to be awesome sort of women foils for RDJ, and that was great. I don't need it from Thor. I want the fantasy stuff from Thor, so I'm repeating myself now, but that's the thing. More of the Asgard homies, please. And Jane versus Sif. Now, this isn't really a fair complaint, because apparently there was a lot more of this in the script, and then Jamie Alexander hurt herself and got taken out of filming for about a month, and they just had to excise a lot of the scenes. But yeah, the love triangle, the sort of the two women that love Thor, and they have this moment in the middle of the film where they meet each other and they both just stare daggers at one another. I wanted more of that. I'm an old romantic. I'm a hypocrite and a sap. I do love a good tragic love story, and I love a good sort of light-hearted love triangle. I think isn't as poisonous a phrase as a lot of people say it is. This was quite a light film, a lot of humour and so on and so forth, and I think the romance could have been sort of played up a bit more as well. If you're going to put Jane in the movie, then, you know, have him making lovey eyes at her a bit more and have some kind of threat to the romance side as well as the adventure, the life-threatening side. And Sif sets that up perfectly. His best friend, who's a girl, and his girlfriend hate each other's guts and he has to deal with it. I would have loved that. So again, I'd have had Sif and the Warriors 3 and Heimdall come with them on this quest through this mental booby-trapped Svartalfheim that I've come up with. Maybe drop off one by one. I wouldn't kill them off because you've got sequels, but maybe, like they do in Asgard, they all come with them so far and then one stays behind for some reason and then another one stays behind. So by the time they leave Asgard, there's just Thor, Loki and Jane. Stretch that out across the whole movie, you know. They get Svartalfheim and Hogan says, right, I will stay here and guard the portal. And they go, right, bye Hogan, you know, and so on and so forth. So that you can play up this Jane Sif thing, you know, as well as keeping an eye on his brother and saving the Nine Realms, he's also got to stop his best mate from twatting his missus. Yeah, I would watch that. And finally, what I've been saying from day one with when the Thor movie came out, and it applies to Avengers and Thor 2, and most frustratingly, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which can't go a full week without reminding us that it's not magic, it's just science, we don't understand yet. Stop saying that. This isn't a Thor 2 fix now. This is a Marvel Cinematic Universe and TV Universe gripe. We get it. It's not magic, it's just science. Fine, you've made your point. Shut up about it now. So that we can, those of us with a bit of imagination can accept magic and just say it's fine. And those of us that can't have had that line in Thor 1 setting it up. They know it's fine. Leave it alone. Like David Cameron still blaming Labour for stuff after God knows how many years. We get the point! Anyway, for the Dark World, fixed. Wow. And there's two more. I can't wait to read them. The Hobbit. The Desolation of Smaug. I'm kidding. I know the books. I know the films. Three films out of one book. So yeah, I want to talk about how I would fix the Desolation of Smaug. Not much I would do to this one, to be honest. It was pretty damn good, if I do say so. If I do say so, I didn't make it, but yeah. It was pretty damn good. A couple of quick ones we'll get out of the way first. More singing. I loved the singing in the first one. I think anyone who didn't love the singing in the first one is a little bit dead inside. I'm not judging you, but there's something missing, okay? Songs are great. They're from the book. Obviously, a lot of arguments about these films are whether or not it's in the book, and people who love the books and the films say, well, it's in the book, so it's fine. And people who love the books and hate the films use it in a different way, and people who hate both, I don't know why they're talking about it, but there you go. But that is one of the things that's straight out of the book. The characters burst into song, or they don't burst into song, but they sit around the campfire and sing quite often in the book. So why not do it in the film? And it's also it's something that a lot of people complained about in the first Hobbit film, whilst sticking by how much they love Lord of the Rings. But characters sing in Lord of the Rings too. Admittedly, it's not a joyful ditty about doing the washing up in Bilbo's kitchen, but you know, particularly the one that won all the Oscars, The Return of the King, two characters just sing in character for minutes at a time. Aragorn one's a bit out of place, but it happens in the film, and Pippin's one's really good. So, we could have had some more in this one. Maybe some more poignant ones, maybe more like Misty Mountains, rather than like Blunt the Knives. But yeah, I would have, like, there's a couple of moments where somebody could have sung. Jimmy Nesbitt, apparently, I've not heard him sing anything yet, but apparently he's got a really nice voice. He sings in the extended edition of the first film. He had a song that was cut. Have him sing something while they're trying to fix Aidan Turner. You know, and he thinks he's going to die, and he sings some kind of mournful dwarven song. I would have that. I'd love that. I just really like, Howard Shore writes great music. Tolkien wrote great lyrics. Not great lyrics, but, you know, poetic, descriptive lyrics. I mean, Misty Mountains, you even without the visuals, you absolutely get that. When you listen to that, you can see the mountain burning, and you can, so yeah, more of that in this film, please. Next thing, this is something we'd dearly like you to use the YouTube comment section on this, because Benji and I disagree on this, and I'm going to alienate a lot of book purists, of which I usually am one. I'm a massive fan of these books. I love these books, and I've been looking forward to the film for a long time because I love the books. But when they get to Smaug at the end, and he's brilliant, by the way, Cumberbatch, oh, the voice is good, the guys, the waiter did the visuals, oh, it's brilliant. Looks brilliant, sounds brilliant, it's a brilliant sequence, love it. If you haven't seen it, go and see it, it's brilliant. But I do have a bit of a qualm in that Peter Jackson introduced this kind of chase with the dragon and the dwarves that isn't in the book. In the book, it's only Bilbo that goes and confronts Smaug and but Bilbo and Smaug have a dialogue, and then Smaug nips off out of the mountain down to Lake Town, and the events of the third film happen at the end of the book. In the film, as well as Bilbo and Smaug having their moment, then the dwarves, not all 13 of them, but I think about 7 of them, or 9 of them, come into the sort of grand chamber, and there's this big game of cat and mouse, and Smaug's chasing the dwarves, and they're splitting up and distracting him, and it's a brilliant sequence, really well done, a lot of good gags in it, some great visuals, it's brilliant. But I kind of think, like, this badass dragon, who's basically kicked the dwarves out of their hometown, and dwarves aren't pushovers in these films. You know, they're a lot more badass in the films than they were in the book. And they're reasonably badass in the book. Or at least in the Lord of the Rings books. And he kicked them out of their home, and then he kept all other interested parties out of that home for years, centuries probably, a couple of hundred years anyway. Because dwarves live for a long, long time. Thorin's a lot older than Richard Armitage. So, you know, Smaug's been in there a while. He's clearly something not to be trifled with. And yet, when nine dwarves and a hobbit come into his home, they're able to basically, they turn him into Tom, to their Jerry. And, you know, he's chasing them around and he can't get any of them. And it didn't take me out of the film, it didn't ruin the film by any stretch of the imagination, but I did kind of think, he's not that badass. You know? So my suggestion would be, and this is where I veer wildly from the page, I would have roasted a couple of dwarves. Yeah, I know, I can sense the comments and emails of complaint flying in, but what I mean is these films have already taken a fair amount of liberties from the books. I've said at length about how much I love the books and how much I love the films, and I do, but they're two very different beasts, especially The Hobbit. The Hobbit is very different to this than Lord of the Rings was to the books. So, clearly, we're not above the royal we. Me, Peter, Philippa and Fran are not above, you know, taking a few of these liberties and veering drastically from what's happened. So why stop? I know from reading the book, and again, I don't want to spoil the third film for anyone who's not seen it, so spoiler alert, not just for the film I'm talking about, but also its sequel and also the book it's based on. I'm going to spoil elements of what's to come. I know which... I'm not really going to spoil them, but I know which dwarves live and die by the end of the third film, and I know which dwarves have something significant to contribute by the end of the third film, if it sticks to the book. And we can afford to lose a couple. The narrative will be exactly the same if, say, one or two of Ori, Dori and Dori dies. No, you can't kill Ori, because he's in the Fellowship of the Ring. His corpse is holding the book in Balin's tomb. Yeah, trivia. And also Balin. It's his tomb. So Ken Stott and Adam... I can't remember your last name. It's probably not even Adam something. But Ori and Balin, fair enough. They have to make it, because they're in the Fellowship of the Ring. Thorin, Fili, Kili, they've all got things... They for plot reasons, they need to stick around. They're going to be significant characters and so on and so forth. But the rest of them, they've not got that much more to contribute. And bearing in mind, there's 13 of them. There's a lot of characters to handle for a book, and then a film, which has limited runtime and screen time. And, you know, there's a lot of characters in this party, plus all the other characters that aren't part of the party, to develop and give time to. So, in a way, you'd be getting rid of some dead meat, and you'd be giving Smaug something, you know, some more menace. And you go, oh, okay, he's really scary, you know. It's like Serenity, spoilers. It's like the reason Joss Whedon killed Wash is not because he hates us all and he knows we loved Wash. At least I hope it's not. I hope Joss Whedon doesn't hate me because he's in charge of a lot of things I love right now. But it's because it yeah. It's to give him. It's to give the Reavers some sort of consequence. Some, you know, you're terrified for the rest of the crew when Wash dies, because you realise, shit, they can die. And that, I think we could do with that in The Hobbit, especially because the tone of the first one was very light, and I don't know if the second one was always intended to be this much darker, or if it was edited in a certain way due to response to the first one. I don't know, but the second one feels a lot more like a Lord of the Rings movie than the first one did. And in The Lord of the Rings, you have Sean Bean dying, you have Ian McKellen dying, okay, and then he comes back. But, you know, death and consequences is a lot more powerful thing in The Lord of the Rings than it is in The Hobbit. So, you know, here's a way you could inject some in. So, there we go. So I'm not saying I definitely want to kill Austin Dwarves, but I would certainly be open to it in the film, bearing in mind that no matter what the film does, nobody's prizing this out of my hands and rewriting bits of it. George Lucas, don't come anywhere near me. So, let us know what you think. Do you agree with me? Do you agree with Benji? Do you think we're both insane and you have your own revisionist take on the thing? Let us know. Final thing for Desolation of Smaug is, again, the result of a deviation from the books that I think made sense for the film. I understand why they did it, and I'm on board with it, but again, I would deviate from the deviation. Azog and Bolg. So Azog is the big pale orc who was the lert of An Unexpected Journey. He was the sort of the physical antagonist for the climax of the film. He is in the book, but he's only referenced when Balin tells the story of Thorin in Moria, the flashback sequence in the first film where the pale orc is introduced. In the book, he dies during that battle. Thorin successfully kills him. He doesn't just take his arm off. And that's the end of Azog. There's no orcs chasing them at the end of An Unexpected Journey, which is about a third of the way through the book. There's just wargs and no orcs. And there's no orcs follow them to Lake Town. The orcs then turn up in the book in the Battle of Five Armies, which you've probably heard about, which is going to happen in the third film. And at that point, they are led by Bolg, who is Azog's son. So the book does kind of suggest that the orc leader is the son of the previous orc leader who Thorin killed. That's all from the book. But Azog still being alive, obviously, is something they changed from the film. And Azog and Bolg both being involved in the events in this middle portion of the story is something they've changed and added into the film. And what I would have done is flip them. Because Azog, basically, he's more awesome than Bolg. The CG model looks better. The fact that he's a pale orc, you know, Bolg's just a particularly gangly, ugly orc, but he doesn't look that different to the rest of the orcs, you know, but Azog really stands out, so I think he makes a great kind of primary villain, you know. So I would rather he was the one that was hot on their trail. I like the idea that he's as obsessed with Thorin as Thorin is with him, so he's chasing Thorin to the Lonely Mountain. He's not licking his wounds in Dol Guldur. He leaves his son in charge to lick his wounds in Dol Guldur. And then what you can do is when Gandalf goes to Dol Guldur, these things are so much fun to say. Think Tolkien knew. In a few centuries, some nerds are going to be making videos about my books and the films that they spawned, and I want them to really wrap their tongue up. Yeah, so Gandalf arrives at Dol Guldur, and he discovers Sauron's there, and you know, the necromancer is Sauron, and Gandalf's been right all along, and all that stuff can happen. But what you could do is you could give Gandalf this awesome sort of tides-turning moment, or give Sauron this awesome tides-turning moment, where Gandalf doesn't just come in, discover it's a bit creepy, try and get out, and then get pinned by Sauron. He comes in, discovers it's a bit creepy, Bolg gets all, I'm going to take Gandalf down, and then Dad's going to think I'm awesome. Then Bolg clears up to Gandalf, and Gandalf pure dead kills him, right? Because he's Gandalf. He owns. Then Sauron's forced to come out because he's like, oh, you know, that's my lieutenant or my lieutenant's lieutenant down. I better take care of this problem. And then we get Sauron. Just, I think it's more satisfying. I'm a bit bloodthirsty. I just want to see Ian McKellen lop somebody's head off because he's awesome at it. So yeah, it's about giving Gandalf a cool sort of action moment rather than... The sequence is fairly cool. He's running away. It's quite scary, you know, but it would be cool to have him win a fight and then the tide turns on him. But more important, I think, is having Azog be on the trail. I'm a big fan of arch-nemesis in literature. You know, that's why I love, you know, Spider-Man and Green Goblin and Wolverine and Sabretooth and Batman and the Joker and so on and so forth. And, you know, Robocop and Terminator, Ang Lee and Louis Leterrier. And so I really love the addition of Azog to these films and the idea that Thorin is... It's not just about getting his homeland back, but he's got this personal beef to settle with the guy that killed his granddad and presumably killed his dad. I like that. And by making Azog as determined to get Thorin, you kind of set up a brilliant clash in the Battle of Five Armies at the end of the third film, or probably in the majority of the third film. So that's what I would do. So there you go. Hobbit, Desolation of Smaug, fixed. You're very welcome. This is the end. Beautiful friend. So... 2013, in a nutshell, that's how I'd have done it. Big nutshell, but there you go. So, yeah, let us know what you think. Do you agree? Do you disagree? How would you fix the films we've mentioned? Are there any other films you would have fixed, and how would you have fixed them? Are there any films you would like us to fix going forward? And that's us. And obviously, Benji's very much in the film-fixing business as well. So please let us know all your thoughts, quibbles, suggestions, and so on in the comments box, which I will not point at. If you've seen our other video, I'll get shouted at. Thanks for your time. Bye.